Welcome back to City Club. For those of you who are first-timers, where have you been? We've had some amazing programs, and we're continuing to roll strong into the spring, even though it's snowing today, I think. But it's springtime. The sun's going to shine soon, and we're going to be back here with so many great programs just like today. So please come back and, of course, join us as members if you're not members, to make sure you're on our list to get first chance at all the great programs. We've been tackling so many different issues and gathering, you know, a diversity of the right civic leaders, people like so many of you in this room who are here today. Welcome back to our favorite president, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Commissioner Bill Lowry, thank you for joining us today. And from the city, we have Commissioner Chris Brown. I also mentioned the library earlier. And Inspector General Deb Witzberg. Jessica Caffrey is here, I believe, from the Cook County Land Bank. All three of those who I just mentioned, former City Club and favorite and future City Club speakers. Keep an eye out. We have some incredible former public servants who are continuing to really serve Chicago. Commissioner Brandon Canazzi, I believe, is here. Former commissioner. Of course, they're all sitting at... David Doig is here. 15 years at CNI. Congratulations, David. Sitting with Pat Cermak, of course. And Meyer Blank is here. Also does so much for the county and the state. The legendary Sherry Runner is at Meyer's table as well. Sherry, thank you for being here. Matt Tully is here next to Mayor Tubbs. Matt, such a great supporter of the City Club. Welcome back to our very own Amanda Agosti. It's because of Amanda's work with Adrian Talbot and the team that we're here today. And so I just want to make a special thanks to Adrian, to the Crown School. Adrian Talbot, please say hello. Our partners at the Crown School, University of Chicago, it's because of this partnership that's been in the works now for a couple of years, really. Maybe six programs, seven. Okay, and I think there may be more to come. But that we've really been able to address some of these hugely important issues and critical issues and continue to explore more that is to come. Thank you, Adrian. Thank you, Crown School. Thank you, University of Chicago. This is important work that you're all doing on the ground and that we're doing here to just elevate the conversation. So that said, in the spirit of partnership, I would like to invite to kick us off now. Please welcome back to the City Club the Dean of the Crown Family School of Social Work and Policy and Practice, of course, Deborah Gorman-Smith. Dean Smith, as you make your way to the podium, I'd like to also invite our panelists to come on up and join us as she's opening our remarks. We have Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, Dr. Maggie Thomas, the Assistant Professor of the University of Chicago Crown Family School, Mayor Michael Tubbs, welcome back, Mayor. Former Mayor of Stockton, California. And then, of course, Amia Pawar from the Michael Reese Trust is going to guide our conversation. Welcome to all of you, and look forward to hearing so much more. And I'll hand it over to the Dean. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Dan. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. I am so happy to welcome you here today again to this event that is co-hosted by the City Club and the University of Chicago Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice. We are so honored to gather with so many committed civic leaders, scholars, and community advocates, all united by the shared purpose of building a stronger and more vibrant Chicago. So I want to thank Dan Gibbons and the entire City Club team for their partnership around this series and creating this space where we can engage in productive conversations about critical social matters. Our focus today is on guaranteed income, a policy approach that's gaining national momentum and showing real promise as a tool for poverty alleviation and economic justice. At its core, guaranteed income challenges us to rethink assumptions about need, dignity, and the role of government in supporting people's ability to thrive. It's an approach rooted in trust and increasingly in research and results. So you heard briefly, we're especially proud that today's conversation features remarkable individuals who are leading the way. Professor Maggie Thomas from the Crown Family School, two civic innovators who turned their ideas into action, President Tony Preckwinkle, whose administration has launched and evaluated one of the nation's largest publicly funded guaranteed income pilots right here in Cook County, and Mayor Michael Tubbs, whose leadership in Stockton, California, helped ignite a national movement through the first modern city-based guaranteed income experiment. Together, this panel exemplifies what becomes possible when research, policy, and public leadership work in concert, when we commit not just to studying problems, but to solving them. If you are intrigued by the conversation today, we are hosting another event this evening at the Crown Family School, where we'll be viewing a new documentary that you can hear about from Mayor Tubbs, and having another panel conversation this evening. All are welcome. So now I want to thank
Tell
you all.
Them feeding them.
Pardon? Tell and them. We are feeding you again. So you will be hungry after this lunch. We are feeding you. So with that, I'm going to hand the mic over to Maya Pawar, CEO of the Michael Reese Health Trust, and also a graduate of the Crown Family School, who will moderate the conversation today. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean. Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be here to talk about this really important topic about how we tackle poverty in meaningful ways. So a lot is happening in the economy right now. The stock market is choppy, and people are suffering as a result of that. Tariffs are making headlines, and there's growing chatter about a possible recession. But beyond these headlines, something deeper has come into sharp focus, something that the panelists here have known for many years, many of you have known for many years, but that the pandemic made undeniable. Millions of Americans have no stake in the stock market directly, and millions don't have even $400 in the bank for an emergency. And this isn't because they aren't working. It isn't because they don't want to work. In fact, it's the opposite. These are individuals that are some of the most resilient people from the most resilient communities in our economy, many working multiple jobs, yet still unable to make ends meet. They are the most vulnerable in our economy. So that's why adding cash to our safety net is gaining traction. It's simple. It's pragmatic. And it helps families and individuals cover basic needs like food, rent, utilities, and transportation. But more than that, it's a bold rethinking of how we address poverty. Today, we're joined by three leaders championing this idea on a scale that is really remarkable and inspirational. Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, Mayor Michael Tubbs, and Dr. Maggie Thomas. Each understands the transformational and transformative power of cash and the urgency of big, innovative solutions to lift people out of poverty. So let's start with you, President Preckwinkle. You were the driver behind the country's largest publicly funded guaranteed income pilot, the Cook County Promise. What motivated you to think about this bold effort, and what have you learned?
Good afternoon. Good. All right. I learned a long time ago that the first thing you have to do whenever you're speaking is thank the appropriate folks. So I'm going to answer the question. But first, Jackie Robinson Ivey, would you stand up, please? Yeah. Many of you know that this organization endured a little bit of turmoil about 5 years ago. And for 4.5 years, Jackie Robinson Ivey has provided the leadership that has helped the organization bounce back and be a kind of focal point of civic engagement in the city of Chicago. So Jackie Robinson Ivey, we thank you. The work I'm going to talk about is, of course, done by my team and not me. So I want to acknowledge all of the county employees that are here starting. I'm going to acknowledge my chief of staff, Lynetta Haynes-Turner, and ask everybody else to stand, please. All of our county employees, thank you. Good things happen because good people do them. So I'm very grateful to all of you for your good work. My colleague on the Board of Commissioners, Bill Lowry, would you stand, please? Thank you. We had unanimous support for this work, and I'm grateful to all of our commissioners for their help and assistance. I also want to acknowledge our partners and ask them to stand. Give Directly Working Credit and the University of Chicago Inclusive Economy Lab. Would you please stand? Dom, did I miss anybody I should acknowledge? Pardon me?
Shriver Center.
The Shriver Center. Thank you. Shriver Center. Thank you. Stand up, Audra. I'd also be remiss if I didn't acknowledge my political staff, which enables me to do my government work. Scott Kastrup, who is my political director, and Jacob Kaplan, who is the staff person for the Cook County Democratic Party. Thank you both for being with us as well. All of these things, needless to say, are a team effort, and so I'm grateful to all the members of the team. You know, I'm a history teacher, so I usually start talking about guaranteed income by referring to Martin Luther King and the Black Panthers from the 1960s. Formative years for me. I realize there are many people in this room who weren't born in the 1960s. However, it was a formative time for me. And Martin Luther King, an American prophet, I always say, said a number of things that I love. You know, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And I always say it doesn't bend of its own volition. It bends because those of us who care about this country work hard to make it a better place. But he also spoke all the time about economic justice and not just civil rights and racial justice, and said we ought to have guaranteed income in this country. So he was talking in the 1960s about guaranteed income. And so were the Black Panthers, a less well-remembered, fondly, organization. But they talked about the fact that everybody in this country should either have guaranteed income or a guaranteed job, guaranteed employment. So bless them both for kind of plowing the ground for this idea. We're grateful for our forefathers and foremothers for the good ideas that they put forward and which those of us today get to try to implement. We are grateful to President Biden and Congress for the money that we got, $1 billion. The state got $16 billion. We got $1 billion, and the city got $2 billion to help recover from the economic collapse that followed the pandemic or that accompanied the pandemic. And one of the things we decided to do with those resources is to provide a guaranteed income program. $42 million, $500 a month, no strings attached, for 2 years, to 3,250 individuals. So $42 million, 2 years, $500 a month, 3,250 individuals. Now, when we noticed up this idea, we got 233,000 applications. So there's a great need, not just in Cook County, but across the country for programs like this, for economic support for our residents. And the main message that I want to deliver is that people use this money in the way that everybody in this room uses their money for shelter and food and medical expenses and transportation. And I think we, in this country, and the roots of it we could have a longer discussion about, we demonize poor people. We say that poverty is their fault, that it's a result of some personal failing on their part. Just garbage. And there's, you know, speculation that people are going to use the money for drugs or alcohol or God knows what. And as I said, they use the money for what everybody else in this room uses the money for. And we have to have more confidence in our fellow citizens, and that they will make good decisions about the resources that are available to them. And cash assistance does that. I've talked a long time. It's probably the next person's turn. But I want to thank Mayor Tubbs. In 2019, he initiated the first government-sponsored guaranteed income program. We're very grateful to him for that good work. Thank you, Mayor Tubbs.
That's a great segue. Yeah. Mayor Tubbs, you're currently on tour, a national tour. For your documentary, It's Basic. It's a critically acclaimed movie that premiered at Tribeca. And the work from that film has been featured in news outlets across the world. It explores guaranteed income pilots, which have really proliferated over the last few years around the country. And your central role in sparking a national movement around cash. And I just want to say, there's been an impact everywhere around the country because of your work. I'll just give you one quick example. A shout out to one of our partners at Michael Reese, Amanda Pyron at the network, is currently piloting a guaranteed income pilot, if you want to just raise your hand really quickly, for survivors of domestic violence. But when you started this work, it was long before the pandemic. It was when it was a lot more risky. And hearts and minds still weren't there yet. There's questions about whether they are there today. So what drew you to guaranteed income? You were a young mayor, kind of like a progressive superstar. But what made you explore guaranteed income?
Yeah, well, first let me say, I don't care what they say, Chicago, you guys are nice. Every time I'm here, I get all the compliments.
So like, who says we're not nice?
I'm not going to bring those people in this room today. When I go home, my wife's like, you must have been in Chicago again. You're feeling yourself a little too much. So thank you, Madam President, and thank you for the question. Really briefly, I want to make sure I recognize Cameron Burns, who's the Deputy Director of Mayors and Counties for Guaranteed Income. And then our dear partners at the Economic Security Project, who provided the seed funding for the Stockton pilot, now is doing great work in Illinois and across the country. But to answer your question, I'm from Stockton, California. It's a city in California, about 320,000 people, 30% poverty. And so many of the issues we worked on and talk about and I talk about now aren't just things I studied at Stanford or worked on as mayor, but they're things I experienced. So I think the proximity to poverty made it a question not of if we can solve it, but we have to solve it, right? And I spent 4 years on city council, and so much of that time was spent dealing with the symptoms of the problem. So I would be exhausted going from – I taught high school full-time, and then maybe in meetings with our police department about safety or in meetings with our school district about literacy rates or in meetings with neighborhoods around food deserts. And it seemed like the root cause was we were talking about poverty in every meeting without talking about poverty. And our efforts were important efforts. They were valiant efforts. They were good efforts, but the needle wasn't moving. The underlying structure of the city hadn't changed. Like, there was going to be a generation of kids who grew up in poverty unless there was some radical intervention. So when I became mayor, I told my staff, I said, look, what can we do to at least begin a conversation about solving the problem? And they came back with some work that had been happening across the world with $1, $2, $5 direct cash transfers, led by our folks I give directly in most cases. And when they came back to me, I said, well, I don't think, I mean, Stockton is cheap, but $2 a month ain't going to get it. Like, and they were like, well, you could just increase the amount. And I was like, we can increase the amount. That's such a great idea. And I remember, to your point, Madam President, in college studying Dr. King and reading Where Do We Go From Here, when he talked about a guaranteed annual income, that was an actual income. It wasn't like $500 or $1,000. It was pegged at the national median income with measures to keep up with inflation. And I've always been fascinated by that idea. So long story short, we decided to pilot it because it appeared to me that the status quo not only wasn't working, but was actually more radical than doing something different. We decided to do it because when I was debating the pros and cons with my staff, they were saying things like, well, people, what if someone spends the money on this or on that? But it all seemed to be based on conjecture and not data. I was like, well, show me the data. Like, how do we know people behave this way? We don't know unless we test it. And then I thought of, like, my mom. She was single. She was 16 when she had me. And she was a magician with money. And the issue was never she didn't know how to manage money. The issue was always there wasn't enough to manage. And if you think structurally, if minimum wage anywhere in this country can't keep up with the cost of rent for an apartment, you could be Warren Buffett. If you ain't got the money, you don't have the money, and you're not going to be able to pay for all the things that need to be paid. So I said, no, I think the vast majority of people will spend the money the way you and I spend money because they're not aliens. They're not subspecies. They're not a different branch of humanity. They are equally as human. And so that's sort of why we took the bet. And the bet was really that the status quo was failing. And as leaders, we have a responsibility to at least question and figure out, can we do better? Like, is this literally the best we can do?
So just to build on that a little bit, from the film, well, why don't we start back up for just a second? Can you level set a little bit about what is guaranteed income and what's universal basic income and what's the difference? Because a lot of people use those interchangeably.
Yeah, universal basic income is the idea that it is essentially direct cash transfers to everyone, regardless of income, no strings attached. And guaranteed income, so universal basic income is a form of guaranteed income that goes to everyone. Guaranteed income is a direct cash transfer with no strings attached to people. It could be everybody, it could be some people, it could be people in poverty, it could be like we saw in the stimulus checks, 90% of the country, 75K and below. And it could be parents with children, like we saw with the child tax credit. It's just basically giving money, direct cash, no strings attached, to a group of folks.
So I'm going to move to Dr. Thomas really quickly.
That's terrible. We talk all day. You get quickly. That's
well,
not me.
But she'll have equal time. I promise that.
Okay.
I'll make sure to cut you off.
That's not fair, Dr.
I'm kidding. You've now heard from two elected political leaders about a policy, about unrestricted cash. But then, of course, there are critics and, of course, there are supporters. But people often say, well, we need to research this. What does the data say? And Dr. Thomas, what does the data say? What do we know conclusively at this point about cash?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for the question. And I will do very brief thank yous since I need my time, apparently. But thank you to the City Club and the Crown Family School for bringing us all together, and to President Preckwinkle and Mayor Tubbs for having this conversation. Really, really pleased to be here. So what does the research say about guaranteed income? There's quite a lot of research that's come out, particularly within the last decade, some of it conducted by my colleagues at the University of Chicago, the Inclusive Economy Lab, and by many other folks around the country, responsive to exactly the questions that both the president and the mayor have highlighted here of actually not having answers to what was going to happen when we gave people cash like this. So there are some things that are pretty well settled in the research and some things that aren't. I think you could hear in the narratives that they both just offered that a big question in the early research here has been about how people were going to spend the money and whether essentially guaranteed income might be harmful, whether people might do things that, quote unquote, they shouldn't, that might be bad for them or bad maybe for the broader economy. And so the parallel for me actually is thinking about medical research and how we start with safety testing. So a lot of the early research has thought about the safety of guaranteed income. Are we going to cause harms if we give folks this money? A lot of the reason that debate happens at all is because of these baked-in assumptions of mistrust that poor folks can't manage their own lives, can't manage money, might inherently not spend money well. And so there's a philosophical conversation to have there. But nonetheless, a lot of the early research has focused on questions of what are the impacts on people's attachment to the labor market? What are the impacts on how much people work if they receive this guaranteed income? What are the impacts on their earnings? And The top line, my read of the research, is that the top line finding is that there are not strong impacts on most of these employment outcomes. Certainly, we do not see people receiving guaranteed income and all dropping out of the labor force. That's just not happening. The research is quite clear that most people remain employed. A number of studies find that folks who are unemployed actually are more likely to become full-time employed than folks who in the control groups who didn't receive the guaranteed income. There's a little bit more mixed evidence on the hours that people work. There's a study that finds slight reduction in the number of hours folks work. It's still a pretty small number. There are also other studies that find no effects on the hours folks work. So all of that sort of detail is just to highlight that if you think about this sort of initial set of questions that are about this almost safety testing, we're not seeing harms from this. And in other domains, we really see benefits. We see reductions in stress, in anxiety, in depression. We see reductions in financial stress specifically. So if you think about the impacts beyond just attachment to the labor force, we see some positives there. And there are a number of other domains we could certainly talk about. I study guaranteed income in the Los Angeles County area. We talk in interviews with parents of young children. We see some really important results there in terms of how the guaranteed income supports those parents. They're able to invest in their children, both in terms in material and quality time ways that they wouldn't otherwise be able to. Folks talk about the ability to take children to specialized therapy, for instance, or to enroll their children in enrichment activities they otherwise wouldn't. So the research is really beginning to settle that there are not harms to this intervention and that there are some benefits.
Thank you. Coming back to you, President Preckwinkle, we've now heard on some of the research. So what were the frequency of payments during the pilot period? And what have you seen in terms of how people use the money and some of the what surprised you, frankly, if anything?
Well, actually, I wasn't surprised. As I said, what people use the money on is what everybody else uses the money on, you know, shelter and food and medical care and transportation. So, I mean, that didn't surprise me. You know, let me come back to this narrative, though, which our representative from academia talked about. You know, the crazy idea that somehow you're going to harm people by giving them more resources is just astonishing to me. There isn't anybody in this room that would feel they were harmed by more resources, right? So why should we think that other of our fellow citizens are somehow going to be harmed by more resources? It's insulting to them. And actually, this whole discussion is in a context of how we have, in this country, allowed ourselves to be divided and how we've allowed certain parts of our population to be demonized. And it's not just on the basis of race, which, of course, I'm really familiar with, but also on your economic standing. You know, there's so many people in this country who work hard and just have a terrible time making it, right? And to not be respectful of them is shame on all of us, you know? Shame on all of us. This is work I'm really proud of, and I'm grateful to our team, Dom and Ryan, are our point people on this in the Bureau of Economic Development. And this doesn't really answer the question, but we want to continue this work because we've got to be part of the national conversation about the importance of guaranteed income. We're grateful to the University of Chicago for the research they are doing and are continuing to do, their review and analysis of our findings. And that research is important. It's an affirmation, I think, of the work and helps us to make the case to those who aren't already empathetic or sympathetic to the idea that we ought to support our fellow citizens. But this is a political will question as much as it is facts. And so we have to continue, especially in this difficult moment, when there's so much scapegoating and efforts to pit us against each other, to be supportive of each other and acknowledge, you know, how hard all of us are trying to make it for ourselves and our families. And one of the ways in which we can do that is to support the idea of a guaranteed income.
Thank you, Mayor Tubbs. What I appreciated about your film is that it doesn't put people on display. It makes the case broadly, expansively about how cash helps people. Are there any moments from the movie that stick with you the most? Because there's how many pilots now that you've been a part of?
Too many. There's
never too many. Yeah. Never too many.
We have only too many. Many in terms of just to your point, build a political will to get to a policy. But I think in Cameron Harish, you guys know better than me. But how many? I don't know.
75 government led, and then 150 total.
So 75 government led pilots and 150 total. Including those led by community groups and nonprofits. But what was the question? I'm sorry.
The question is there anything? Well, I mean, that's a lot. I mean, that is quite an achievement, and I think it deserves a round of applause because I'll say this because when I was on the council, I chaired a task force on guaranteed income several years ago with ESP and Harish Patel, with your support, Mayor Tubbs. The anger about cash from people who you would assume to be on your side was palpable. What do you think about Hearts and Minds today as with all of these pilots?
Yeah, well, part of the reason why we made a feature-length documentary wasn't because we were bored. It was because after the data came out let me backtrack. I'm a very sort of simple person. Like, I have an idea or a belief, but if you give me data that says that belief was wrong, I'm like, oh, wow, okay, I was wrong, let's fix it. And I thought most people operate like that, but apparently that's not the case. So when the guaranteed income we launched, people were saying people are not going to work, people are spending on drugs. So I'm like, okay, we don't know. So I assumed when the data came out that conversation would be over. But 7 years later, I'm having the same debates on Twitter and same debates everywhere about whether people work, about whether people are using the money on drugs, about whether guaranteed income is a good thing based off data. So because of that, in 2021, I said, well, for this to really kind of catch legs and to get to a policy, we have to do a better job of storytelling. Because I think when we talk about guaranteed income, we're really pushing back on myths that are as old as our country itself, right? And I think, and the president alluded to it earlier, but the first myth we're pushing back on is this idea of the dignity of work, as if one's dignity is attached to your production. And that's a holdover from slavery, where you literally were valued based off what you could produce, right? And I think so much of the narrative is like, dignity of work, dignity of work, but there's nothing dignified about working two jobs and not be able to pay rent. There's nothing dignified about working without union protections or working without knowing your hours. There's nothing dignified about working yourself to death and still not being able to make bills at the end of the month. And part of the work we have to do is move that conversation from the dignity of work just to basic human dignity, that our dignity is inherent and it's not predicated on what we produce. The second sort of big myth we've had to push up on is this idea that people who are poor aren't working. And our language even tells us that. We have a term for it, the working poor. Working poor. How is that not an oxymoron? Like, what are people working for if they're working and poor? So really illustrating to people, no, when we talk about guaranteed income, we're not talking about for folks who aren't deserving. We're not talking about folks who are just taking. We're talking about folks who are working because the vast majority of people in this country who can work do work. If people don't work, it's because they're doing domestic work at home, which is still work. It's because they're either sick or differently abled, or they face barriers to employment. And so the third myth we had to combat was that this is just something for black people, right? We have a big legacy of racism in this country that we have to address. So all those reasons, let's put this on film. So the film, we follow white people who receive guaranteed income. We follow white men who receive guaranteed income. We follow black people. We follow Latino people. We follow people in the Midwest. We follow people in the West. Just to show folks that this is not about a them. This is about a you. This is about what you need and you deserve. Because I think you mentioned it earlier in your intro. It's not a fringe group of folks. Half of this country, before the stock market crash and before the incoming recession, couldn't afford a $400 emergency. This is not some niche group. This is the majority of folks in this country. So part of the work of Change of Hearts and Mind is getting people to see it's not just about them, but it's also about you and your family and your future, and not having a ceiling, but just making sure everyone has a floor, that no one deserves to have nothing when everyone's contributing to the things that do make our country have the potential to be great.
Thank you. And Dr. Thomas, this is where it seems to me like perhaps we should be asking different questions. Before when we were prepping for today, you talked a little bit about we already give away lots of cash through policy. And yet we're still having the conversations about narrative and deservedness, et cetera, et cetera. Can you speak more about kind of how can we ask better questions and what kind of questions do we need to ask?
Yeah, I do think that's research's role. So research can begin asking questions that help us move beyond this narrative about, you know, sort of safety or basic deservingness. We could stop asking questions about whether people are going to spend guaranteed income on the things we think they ought to versus the things we think they don't, whether they're going to stop working or not. We do have some pretty clear answers to that. So what research can do now is ask questions. I was just thinking, as Mayor Tubbs spoke about work, we can ask much more nuanced questions. So my team right now is asking questions about work that are sort of much more textured than these questions about whether or not you're working and how much you're working. We're hearing from families, for instance, about maybe not changing your job at all, but being able to drop a second job so you can stay in a job that's really flexible, that lets you manage your childcare obligations as well. That there's a lot of nuance to what this cash that you can count on can provide people in terms of all kinds of domains of their lives, but even the ones that we've been talking about, like work. So I do think that that's what we can do as researchers moving forward, is ask creative questions that help us really understand people's lived experience, that treat people as having innate dignity and being able to help us understand what their lives are like when they have different cash resources coming in. So some of the unanswered questions, some of the questions I think we ought to be thinking about as we consider where guaranteed income programs can go from here are more about the details of what these programs can or could look like. We have given folks different amounts of money for different lengths of time in really different cities and counties and places across the country. We don't have a settled answer, and there's probably not a single answer in terms of what that should look like if we were going to advocate a policy at the federal level or advocate a policy that every city adopt. So we can ask questions about how much money we should give to folks, for how long. We could think strategically about whether there are groups of folks who might need certain kinds of cash benefits that look different than other groups, and we could study those groups. So I think those are some of the kind of more nuanced questions we could begin asking if we as a community, as a country, could agree to sort of move past these frontline questions about whether there are harms to this policy or whether we could accept that poor folks can spend resources provided to them as best meets their needs.
This for both Mayor Tubbs and President Preckwinkle. We're in a moment right now, right, where there's a lot of cruelty and chaos and fear coming out of the federal administration, and also in a moment where guaranteed income, thanks to your work, has gained a lot of traction and pushback. What's your vision look like for guaranteed income locally and nationally, and what's it like, you know, navigating this resistance and the gains?
I talked earlier about the federal resources that we got to deal with the economic aftermath of the pandemic. We decided to spend this $42 million on guaranteed income, and I made a pledge at the time that we would continue this program. We started up, I'm told, a little bit more than 70 new initiatives. This is the only one that I promised we would continue. And even in the present turmoil and tumult, we're going to keep that promise. As I said, I mean, all of this work can't be retrospective. People have to be involved in it now and be able to continue to advocate for it, support research about what the results are. And you have to have a program kind of to do that. So we're going to continue this work, at least as long as I'm in this office. So,
yeah, and very briefly, let me just say, first of all, I neglected to mention that Your president is also co-chair of Counties for a Guaranteed Income, so she's also helping influencing other county officials. But no, it's the best of times and the worst of times, right? We started the pilot in Stockton under the first Trump presidency, and Marriage for Guaranteed Income was also launched under the first Trump presidency in the height of a pandemic during the George Floyd protests. Very, very times of turmoil. And I think for me, that's been a reminder of sort of sometimes these extremes, perilous times also provide an opportunity for leadership and also provide an opportunity for us to test our conviction vis-a-vis the conviction of folks who have a different view of the world and how this country should operate. So to that end, we're now beginning an effort to organize legislators, because we think with the federal government being what it is, there's still some states like Illinois, like California, like Colorado, like New York, where you have a Democratic trifecta. And where if you can't get to guaranteed income for everyone, you could do a guaranteed income for foster youth, for example, aging out the system at a state level for a couple of $1 million. You could do a guaranteed income for people experiencing homelessness. You could do a guaranteed income for pregnant people, et cetera. So there's ways to get it as we seek to get to everyone, and we'll continue doing that fight. But I would say the past 2 years has been an effort on the other side to ban guaranteed income programs. So part of the traveling I've been doing has been I spent a lot of time in Houston. Harris County last year, because Attorney General Paxton was suing the county, Commissioner Ellis and Judge Hidalgo, from doing a guaranteed income program for folks in Houston, saying it violated the Texas Constitution. We spent some time in Wisconsin last year working with the governor and some legislators because there's an effort in their house to ban guaranteed income programs. So what we're seeing with this momentum is that folks have a different view are now organizing, trying to ban folks from even trying. Ban folks from even having a conversation about it. Ban cities from doing it. And so our work continues, and now it's just a little more conflict and much more fight, but the stakes are so high. The cat's out the bag. There's so much momentum. There's so many stories that if we keep focused and committed, we'll get to the end goal one day, which is a federal guaranteed income policy. Well, first we have a federal government first. That's the first battle. Make sure we have federal government. And then with the federal government have a federal guaranteed income policy.
So thank you. I'm going to interrupt here. And I do have a couple of questions from audience members we always like to incorporate into the conversation. Before I do that, though, I'd like to ask if anyone has one they'd like to ask in person. I've got a microphone here. If you want to raise your hand, I'm happy to bring this out. One of them is from someone who I think is in the room, was mentioned earlier, Amanda Pyron. Amanda, right over here. Do you want to ask your question, or do you want me to just ask it here?
I don't know if I remember.
So let's do a mix of the two. I can remind you, but I think it's nice for you to say hello.
Sure.
And
didn't expect to get a call out when I put in a question, so apologies for that. Cook County is experiencing a significant spike in domestic violence homicides in 2025. How can guaranteed income programs be utilized to increase safety for survivors of gender-based violence?
Thank you for allowing me to do that.
So our program was not focused on any particular segment of the population. We put out the information about the qualifications for the program. And as I said, we got 233,000 responses. We didn't, as Mayor Tubbs suggests, focus on any part of the population, domestic violence survivors, youth aging out of foster care, people coming out of detention or imprisonment. It was a general call. My view is we need to do this for everybody. And so I guess that was the basis of our foundation. That was the foundation of our program, and that's still where I want to be.
Can I speak really briefly to that question? So there is some evidence from the evaluation of a guaranteed income pilot in the city of Los Angeles, where they did focus specifically on intimate partner violence. And that evidence is promising. There were reductions in experiences of intimate partner violence and in severity of violence among folks receiving guaranteed income compared to the control group who weren't. And some of the mechanisms that sort of emerged in their evaluation focused on folks being able to exit relationships that they felt felt financially trapped in otherwise when they had the guaranteed income available, and being able to do more upfront safety planning, being able to rely on savings they could make with their guaranteed income payments, such that if things changed in their intimate relationships, they were then able to exit later. So that's only one evaluation, and it is contextualized, but they had some really promising results, and I'm certainly happy to talk about it further with you if you'd like to.
Great. Does anyone else? I have one more question here.
Go right ahead.
Do I stand?
Sure.
Hi, I'm Miguel Abad Juarez. I'm with Loyola Student Development, and this is directed to Dr. Thomas. I just wanted
to
ask.
Keep the mic up to your mouth.
Oh, sorry. Thank you. Did the frequency of deposits of guaranteed income show significant differences on the levels of stress, anxiety, and depression between individuals? Thank you.
Did you say the frequency of deposits?
Yeah, the frequency of deposits, did the changing on a scale, like if it was biweekly, if it was monthly, or if it was different scales?
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a great question. So that's the kind of nuanced question that I think programs and researchers want to be answering, and that we mostly don't have good evidence on right now, particularly because while we do have some variation in how frequently people received money, it's mostly variation from program to program rather than within a program. So it's a little bit harder to make these direct comparisons. So I don't have a data-driven answer to that right now, but I think that's exactly the kind of question we want to ask is, does it matter, for instance, if we give folks, let's say, a one-time lump sum payment of $10,000, or a monthly payment of $1,000, or a weekly payment? You could see those having really different effects. We know, for instance, that when folks get other benefits on a monthly basis, people report, for instance, their food stamp benefits, their SNAP benefits, running out by the end of the month. So when we pay monthly, it's hard to stretch that support across the month. Would it be better to offer SNAP benefits, twice a month? We don't actually have good evidence on that, so we don't have the evidence here, but I think that's the kind of thing we should be asking. Thanks for your question.
I'll throw it back to you, Mara, if you want to if you want to close out with any thoughts. We have about 2 or 3 more minutes.
Sure. So I want to thank our panelists today, and before we go, I know there are probably many in this audience who could use this. When you think about the future of reducing poverty, and you think about the future generally, what gives you hope in this moment? And what bold ideas and innovations are you thinking about? We're going to start here with President Preckwinkle.
I cheerfully describe this present moment as a nightmare. But so I'm a history teacher. I remind myself, particularly I remind black people, that we have survived 250 years of enslavement and 100 years of serfdom, and things have been worse. And we have survived and thrived in spite of that, and we will survive and thrive in spite of this. That doesn't mean... As I said, it doesn't mean it isn't a nightmare. But you have to have a longer time horizon than just the next 4 years, when we think about this country. What gives me hope? I mean, there were demonstrations this past weekend. That's a good thing. I mean, those of us who believe this country can be a different place than the vision that Donald Trump has for it have a lot of work to do. And I'm encouraged by the fact that throughout our history, people have been willing to step up and do that work.
I think Stacey Abrams said it best a couple years ago when she said, I'm not hopeful, I'm determined. I'm focused. I'm adamant. I'm resolute. And I also think that pessimism is such a luxury. It's a luxury to be despondent and pessimistic when you have a good government job that's not federal, so you're not going to get laid off. Or you are a civic leader. Or you work at a foundation. That's such a luxury. But for the folks that I think of, the folks in my community, the undocumented folks who do a lot of landscaping and child rearing, and how they have to wake up every day and still, come to work without knowing if they'll be deported to El Salvador, whether or not they're from there. I just think that the stakes are too high, and we have too much privilege to not be determined, because at least we have agency. At least we have the ability to do something. And to your point, Madam President, I was reflecting on this the other day, is that when we read history, we think of it as like these grand actions that happen and change the course by a lot of people. But history is really made at the margins. It's small things. It's one bus boycott in one small city in the south of Montgomery. It's one little girl going to school. It's one woman sitting down on the bus. It's not the masses. It's folks who are saying, no, I believe it can be different, and bending the arc of the universe to that. And I'll be quiet after this, but like 15 years ago, I was on the Freedom Rides reenactment with some of the original Freedom Riders. And what was fascinating to me was that, like, these folks were like regular people. Like, they were Freedom Riders, but now they're like bus drivers, or now they're like teachers, or now they're like accountants. They were movement heroes, but 50 years later, there's like normal grandparents, like it's like normal folks who did extraordinary things at a time that was bleaker and darker than this. So that's what gives me hope, is this idea that not only have we been here before in a weird dystopian way, it's actually been worse. Like, this is actually the best of the worst. Like, this is like the most agency and ability we've had in the worst of times, and that gives me hope that enough of us will do something so that 50 years from now we're having the same conversation. And then in terms of bold policy ideas, innovations, I think one of the things we're talking about in California now is a sort of, it's going to be really nerdy, so a sort of data dividend or AI fund, where like everyone in California benefits from the gains we're going to see with AI, particularly if we're talking about displacement, particularly if we're talking about quote-unquote efficiency gains, just making sure that not just 10 people, but everyone whose data and manpower and insights feed the LLMs has a stake in its growth. So that's the nerdy thing I'm excited about right now.
Thank you.
I'm really hopeful that we're having this conversation about reframing poverty, but maybe also just humanity, in terms of thinking about people as having inherent dignity and having the right to self-determination. And I was thinking about the way Mayor Tubbs was talking about these little things. And when you talk to folks who get guaranteed income, they essentially, to a person, talk about better, feeling better in a number of different ways. So we have some really important experimental evidence on sort of more concrete outcomes, but these kinds of programs convey trust from your government or your community to people. They do empower people to feel like they have more choice and they have more agency. And so the fact that this group of folks in the room today is here to talk about and to embrace the idea that we could think about people as having inherent dignity and have conversations about how best to meet their needs, but start from that shared point, I find that really hopeful.
So in closing, I'll just say that, you know, we have people up here that are not just transforming lives, but they're saving lives, truly saving lives. And now you all are all ambassadors. Hearts and minds matter. So hope that when you leave here today, you'll think about this in your daily lives as you think about the issues that you care about and how that then translates into things you support. Thank you so much.
What a perfectly City Club way to wrap it up. Everyone here does make a difference and can make more of a difference. Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Thank you, Mayor Tubbs. Thank you, President Preckwinkle. And, of course, thank you, Mayor Pawar, for hosting this discussion. I've got all sorts of notes and some follow-up, as you can imagine, for future programs and future ideas to keep this keep these conversations going. Thank you. And speaking of conversations, there are going to be plenty more. I hope you all will come back. We've got one on April 15th on reducing gun violence, how the community and the police are working together. We've got one on the imperative investing in black men and fathers on April 22nd. The incoming Park District Superintendent, Carlos Ramirez Rosa, is going to sit down for a chat and let us know what his big thoughts are before he takes the reins at Chicago Park District. And then the CPS New Arts Education Plan, we're going to be talking about that on May 7th. One other quick thing that I'm going to mention, we're going to have a conversation with, and you talk about real people who are impacted by all of this. We're going to have a conversation on April 21st in the evening. We haven't announced this yet. Lieutenant Governor Stratton is going to help lead it, but we're going to have conversations with real people, with women who have been impacted by actual investments, and hear some actual stories and have some real conversations over some food and some drinks and really elevate some of those amazing stories from people who have directly been impacted. Really looking forward to that. It's kind of a new format, and that's going to come out soon, but in just a couple of weeks. So there's so much more to come. We appreciate everybody's attendance here. We certainly appreciate your panelists, all of your time. We're all busy people in the Crown School. Again, thank you. You're all welcome back at City Club very soon. Have a great day.